Hello and welcome to Growth Coaching International's Coaching in Education podcast. I'm your host, Richard Reid, and for over 2 years now, I've had the privilege of talking to an amazing range of educators with a focus on developing coaching in educational settings. In our Stories from the Field series, we have covered a vast range of contexts, which has been hugely beneficial to our listeners from around the globe. However, this conversation today brings a whole new level of challenge to developing coaching in a school. To date, most of our guests have shared their experiences within one specific setting. Primary school, post-primary school, a state school or a private school, and maybe even an international school amongst others. But no one has yet to share a story of developing a coaching culture in three separate schools at the same time. Let me introduce you to our guest, Justine Smythe. Justine is currently an executive principal working with the Victorian Academy of Teaching and Leadership based in Melbourne, Australia. However, only a few years ago, Justine was to take on the formidable challenge of amalgamating no less than three neighbouring primary schools and settling them into a brand new build. Let me share a quote at this point from John Cotter. In its most basic sense, leadership is about mobilising a group of people to jump into a better future. Today, Justine is going to share with us how she mobilised these three groups into one better future that paid respect to all three schools. Justine, I'm delighted that you're able to join me on the podcast today.
I'm delighted to be here, Richard.
Looking forward to this one. Justine, could you share a little flavour of your journey through education so far and how you arrived at the Victorian Academy of Teaching and Leadership?
Yeah, no problem, Richard. I probably didn't have a traditional path into teaching. I did start at Melbourne University after finishing year 12 here, and I did 3 years of university and then was selected to do the fourth year. They brought in a fourth year and I did a fourth year, but the government just didn't have jobs for us. We just weren't able to get into teaching, and it was a really long, hard task. So I went back and did a business degree and worked in business and finance for probably 10 years before getting back into teaching, and only landed in teaching again really because my husband and I moved to regional Victoria where I am now, and my daughter started primary school and they needed a teacher desperately. And they said, hey, you're a teacher. I said, oh, I don't think I could do it still. So I sort of fell back into teaching because I had two little ones and it was probably a good job for me to be doing with the children. So jumped straight back into teaching. Never thought I would be a teacher after being out of it for so long, but loved it. Really enjoyed being back in the classroom and quickly sort of got into roles and doing different things and moved through the system quite quickly. I then moved into the state system and went into leadership roles from there and then to APs and to principals. So it wasn't a traditional journey as such that people start their career and continue it, you know, sort of through the one system. So, but I think it gave me skills and views that were quite different from just always being in a school, and probably gave me a different skill set too.
Yeah, I'm sure that, as you say, I mean, it wasn't a traditional route into teaching, but as you say, there's bound to have been a huge number of benefits. I mean, that period of time, 10 years, as you say, before moving back into teaching again, it's bound to be a tremendous number of experiences that you were able to carry with you into the role. Justine, could you give us some insight into how you became interested in coaching? Maybe who or what inspired you to get involved and I suppose really start to see the benefits of developing coaching skills?
Yeah. Look, I thought about this and I think being a teacher, you naturally fall into that way. You want to help and impart and help people be their best version of themselves. So I think we naturally sit in that mode. That role of coach, being a teacher, whether it's with students or other people. And when I started back in the Catholic system, I quickly was sort of put in the role of being a numeracy leader and helping with pedagogy across the school and to improve that. So that was probably my first taste of coaching. I didn't really understand what I was doing or what it looked like, but I guess there's some innate part of me as a teacher that was able to work with people and support them to improve their practice. So that was probably the first taste of it I had. I then moved across to the Catholic state system and I was made a team leader when I was appointed in the state system. So then I had a team of seven teachers. It was seven, yeah, because two part-timers. And my role was to support them, align practices and pedagogy. So there was a coaching element there. It was more mentoring and supporting, I suppose, though, in coaching. as a team. It wasn't sort of that individualized coaching or coaching conversations. There was conversations about practice and things, but it was sort of, I suppose, less formal. The more formal role for me began when a new member of staff came into our school. Her name was Kathy Hardy, and she had been involved in the GLIS program. So it was the Gippsland Literacy Intervention Support Program, and it was a new sort of initiative in our area to help lift literacy skills in disadvantaged schools. And she had been part of it, and she was moving in to be a coach, and she wanted me to work with her. So she was going to support me and be my coach. But the aim was that sort of gradual release of responsibility, and the following year I would become a coach. So that's when it was really formalised, and I was coached, mentored, supported, watched behind screens, teaching, all those sort of things, and given a lot of feedback. It was quite intense, actually. Yes. You were videoed, you were given feedback on your practice and all those sort of things. And the following year, I moved into being a coach, and I did the role of what Kathy did, and that's what probably really, and she became the coach of the coach. So my role was being a coach, but she then gave me feedback on my coaching conversations. So that's probably when it became much more formalized and I became more interested in it. I obviously did readings and research. I had practice and was given feedback on that. I worked with teachers, and I work with sets of teachers across the school. So that's where it began. And I guess as I've moved into principal roles and assistant principals roles, I've moved out of that pedagogy part of coaching and more into that leadership part of coaching. So I think it's changed over my journey of where I've sat in my roles, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it does. It's quite interesting to hear that, I suppose, evolution. You know, from an initial interest, as you say, as a teacher, you know, it's part of our way of being. I suppose as teachers, we want to support people. And then a colleague coming in and, I suppose, giving you a real purpose when it comes to literacy, you know, so we're trying to improve literacy, you know, within the school. So there's a reason and a justification for this. And then, as you say, and you use the word intense, I mean, to be recorded and to get, you know, feedback on performance and how you're evolving and developing those skills, I suppose quite intimidating, but at the same time, quite enlightening. And I suppose you probably would have seen the skill set, you know, significantly improve once you got to that stage. In the lifetime of a school leader, Justine, we experience many different things, and occasionally we have to lead through a period of change so significant and complex that we feel we may never see the like of it again. For many leaders, yourself included, Justine, we could point obviously to the pandemic. However, for you, there was another significant period of change, and that was leading the amalgamation of three neighbouring primary schools from the original settings into a new build. Firstly, can you give us just a bit of an overview of what were you tasked with?
Yeah, it was a big task. So I was employed to bring three schools were closing, three quite old schools and very traditional schools that had been established for over 100 and hundreds of years. My school was up for its 150th year, and it was being closed. So very strong sort of cultural piece in the community, each of these individualised schools, but very old buildings that were in need of repair and very old ways of teaching and, you know, really old buildings, that the first buildings that, you know, you taught in one big classroom with open fires. So the task was to close that, and we had a massive state-of-the-art new school built on a new site that the government was moving us all into. So the task was to bring those three communities together. I called them three tribes, and yes, the three tribes were not just the staff, they were also the students and the parents, because they were each had a unique affiliation with the school they'd been at. And you know, that cycle of I went there, so my kids are going to go there, there was that whole breaking of tradition that was really complex for people, and I had to bring them together, and I had to align practice and get better outcomes for the kids. Basically was my goal. And it was really challenging, because you can imagine I didn't get to choose any staff that were ongoing within the three schools automatically came across. I had three business managers, I had six numeracy coaches, three wellbeing officers. All those sort of things were really complex, and I had to navigate the staff at one level, the students who didn't want to be together, that were really complex in themselves and fighting for that alpha our authority in the school and then parents who saw me as someone who had taken away what they believed was the school that was right for their children. So they're really complex, yeah. And throw in that a building of a kinder and a long daycare, which also was built on the site, and a Coleman Foundation, which was from philanthropic money, which came in to the school to support a community that needed support with medical things and really bridging that gap between disadvantage and early start education. So, yeah, so it was complex, probably more complex than I ever thought when I took the job. Yeah.
I can imagine just reading through the initial question, Justine, and I can understand your first response is actually to chortle a little bit when you think, goodness me, that really was a complex task. And I suppose even at the time, had you sat down and really thought through what was at stake here, you might well have run a mile, you know. And I think when you talk about, you use the phrase long established buildings, obviously physically they've been in, you know, they've been up for a long, long time, but also long established ways of teaching. And the two seem to go hand in hand, which I think is quite interesting. So it's one thing looking at buildings that have been up for a long, long time and we can get attached to them. And it's hard to leave them behind, and that's understandable. But the bigger challenge probably when I'm thinking about this is those long-established ways of teaching and trying to move. You know, you talk about the three tribes and actually the phrase breaking of traditions and trying to align the outcomes, you know, of all three tribes, which I think is a fascinating story. For some leaders, there is huge challenge in amalgamating just two schools. How did you set about bringing, essentially, to use your phrase, Justine, three separate tribes together to establish one new culture? And the important thing is here that paid respect to all three.
Yeah, look, it was a challenge. And I think an added complexity to it, Richard, was I had been the principal of one of the schools that were closing. So for me, I had to be really mindful that I didn't privilege the school I'd come from and that I really honoured the three journeys of the three schools. So I was really conscious of that. And I think many of the staff from the other two schools were really reluctant to have me as their principal because they thought that I would favour what we'd done at the one school, which I didn't. I was really mindful of that. And the journey probably began before my appointment, and the three schools had to work together. And one of the ideas that we established was to develop working parties. So we set up working parties that had joint people from each of the schools, you know, wellbeing, maths, a numeracy one, a literacy one, a sort of an inquiry one, or, you know, alternative, you know, geography and all those sort of things. Yeah. So we set up different working parties and put people across them. And one of the things that we first did was we just got each school to share what they did. Okay. So they just told what they did at their school. So we actually honoured that first. And then from that, they looked at, we got some Venn diagrams out. What is the same? Where's the crossover? Where are the differences? So we looked at that, and then we made decisions on what does best practice say about what we should be doing in school. So we looked at the research and we looked at what needed to be done. And over that journey, we made really clear decisions about what we were going to implement first and what it was going to look like as a starting point. And it included going out to the parents, going out to the students. What things did they want to see in their new school? We spent a lot of time having working parties with parents, listening to them, listening to students. We developed our school values from what the community wanted. We developed our school uniform, our school name. They all had buy-in to those things. So I wanted to make them feel that this was their school. They owned the school with me, yeah, and my job was to lead it alongside them. So I think that was really important, mm-hmm, that I set that tone really early to begin with and came with an open-mindedness that even though that my school academically had been performing better than the other two schools, mm-hmm, it was my way wasn't the right way. This was a brand new setting and I had to be open to finding out what would work in a brand new setting with open plan rooms.
Yes.
Open plan buildings and buildings we'd never even taught in before. We'd had the old portables with closed doors. So really different way of being and teaching in a school where there's no doors and there's no classrooms and you're an open plan unit, do you know what I mean? So I then went out and visit schools. I visited other schools that had new buildings and I spoke to the principals. I went to schools that had just opened. I visited schools with my leadership teams from the three schools. the schools that had our place centres on them, schools that had kinders on them, what worked, what didn't work, did a lot of research around what was needed to be done. And then I employed an expert, Tracy Azard, to come in and work with the three schools. She's a cultural expert. And she, I thought for me, you know, I can't come in with my lens because they're going to just see it as my old school. Let's bring an expert in. Yeah. She spent time honouring the journeys of the three schools and really celebrating what they'd achieved over their time, and then brought us all together with common threads of what we needed to do to develop. And she worked with us the first year of the school as well. And I brought her back sort of periodically through the journey just to touch base around the culture and develop that side of it. So I also sought expert help from outside when I needed it, because I knew that there were things beyond me that needed to have an individualized lens of an expert. And one of the big things is we started on was I, in my research, I'd come across Berry Street Education, and that was around, you know, restorative practices and trauma-informed practices, which is the school had a lot of trauma-informed students. And I stumbled across the work of Victor Zabar and Orderly Learning Environments, and he had an article that I still have and I still love about disadvantaged schools punching above their weight, and the things that he did and the research that showed what you can do in disadvantaged areas. So a lot of research around those things before I even, you know, contemplated what we were going to do. But I had the things that I knew were going to work from my research and trying to align that with the visions and the work that came out of the working party, so I could honour that as well. So I tried to find a balance of what was important from the research and the work that the teams had done, and we started with Orderly Learning Environment was where we started, and setting up an environment where children were centre, children were going to learn, and we would give them an environment where they felt safe and secure. So that's where we started. Yeah. That was immensely challenging, as you can imagine, because everybody had different opinions about behaviour and what that looked like and how it should work. And, you know, a lot of people believed welfare should have been over that, and that, you know, you support by wrapping welfare around, but children need consistent boundaries and expectations and consistency and fairness. So, I took all of their ideas and I developed a behaviour plan that we were going to implement, and I made a decision from all of that. And I said the very first day I gave them an article to read on high expectations and what, you know, lifting the bar and raising the bar for students that come from disadvantaged communities. And they were all like, oh, but they're more well kids. I said, well, then you lift them higher, because this is what we're going to do. And we read that article, and I sat down and introduced the behaviour model that we were going to introduce around, because the behaviour was quite extreme in the schools. I'd sort of been up and researched and seen what was happening in the schools, and said, this is where we start, but this is our starting point, and I'm really happy to look at it in 3 months and 6 months and adjust it to what we need. But this is a brand new school and we need something to start with. We cannot just have anarchy and disarray every day in our classrooms, and this is where we're going to start. So I made decisions, but I made informed decisions based on research, based on the work that we had done collectively, and then stepped up and said, this is where we're going to start.
Yeah.
It had challenges, absolute challenges. But I think, you know, that ripple effect, and probably where the coaching came in, I started with my leadership team and I supported them, had conversations with them, modelled for them, had all the restorative conversations in front of them, trained them, brought in experts to talk about how we use a restorative process, what positive behaviour looks like. All the while we were doing the training in Berry Street, so I was developing a common language, a common understanding of what trauma does to students and how it affects behaviour and how we need to be in control of that behaviour, and voice raising, yelling, all those things don't work with trauma kids. So I walked the hard yards. I dealt with every behaviour issue. I sat over it. I worked with families. I worked with parents. I modelled. My leadership slowly came on board, then it rippled through the school from people saying, and I think the hardest thing was we had to start with a shared expectation and shared ownership of kids, and they wanted to just say, no, these are my kids I teach, this is the only ones I'm worrying about. Mm. In actual fact, we collectively own all the children, and our job is to be consistent, no matter if you're teaching PE or if you're teaching art or in the yard, our yeah. behaviour needs to be consistent and that orderly environment needs to be consistent. So it was challenging, yeah, mm-hmm. to and there were times I thought, what have I done? This is never, ever going to work, because you are not only trying to do that, you're trying to start teaching and learning, and you're trying to put processes in place for things like yard duty and bells and all the things that you can imagine don't even exist in a new school because they've not been done before. So you're trying to do that alongside the other work that you're doing. And I got to 6 months and I just thought, I just had this line outside my door of behaviour, kids. I had parents, I had staff yelling at me, and parents telling me they weren't happy and pulling their kids from the school. And I sat there and thought, oh, my God, this is so hard. This is really, really challenging. Maybe I've chosen the wrong path. And I sat with my leadership team and they said, no, Justine, we looked at the data, we are seeing movement. It doesn't feel like it, but we're actually seeing movement, and what we're dealing with now is a core set of behaviours from a core set of kids. Let's stay the ground. Let's keep going. And I think by 9 months I felt that real whoosh, you know, the whoosh of implementation, and the language changed in people. They talked about our kids and they talked about being collective responsibility for behaviour, and I felt this sort of shift. So that was really exciting, and that was probably the shift that started change and trust within the community, trust within the teachers and students, and gave me the foundation for the following years to implement pedagogy and change and things that needed to be done to support actual academic learning. Yeah. Yeah, so and I guess one of the things is it was the small steps. I can think back now and think about it seemed overwhelming at the time, but it was those small steps that I look back now that I just made a little tone here, a little step here, a little goal here was reached, and all those little steps, you know, when I looked back, I was up the ladder.
Well up the ladder, I'm sure. And that's what was intriguing me when you were going through your answer there, Justine. And I mean, my head was buzzing with dozens of different questions to ask, because I've got my principal's hat on. Whenever you, time scale wise, so you were having these conversations initially. I love that idea of the Venn diagrams. You have these three separate groups of people, the three tribes, and you're actually physically drawing Venn diagrams on a page and sharing, you know, what's the same, where's the overlap, and then moving into very, very, very clear research. This is going to be based on research, academic research. We want to look at what has been researched around the country and beyond. And you took staff yourself to other schools, but also staff to other schools to see how it had been done elsewhere. But then there was a very, very clear section where you set down the ground rules. These are the boundaries. And this is what we expect. And you mentioned there high expectations. Now, you sort of almost answered my question there about the 9 month period when you saw a little bit of a shift. What sort of time scale are we talking about? Before moving into the actual buildings, you were sitting down to talk to the three tribes. Roughly what sort of time scale was it from drawing that first Venn diagram to seeing that shift in language to our children? What sort of time scale would that have been, Justine?
I reckon it would have been a year, because we'd started our journey with the three schools before the school opened. So we were still all working in our individual schools when we started the Venn diagrams and the working parties and trying to develop some relationships and trust. And so I think probably a full year, but 9 months of working together in the one school is before I really, really, I think term three, so that would be, 9 months in, probably between 6 and 9 months, I felt a shift of it just felt like something lifted, and it felt like there was a common interest to move forward. And that's not everyone. Don't get me wrong. That wasn't everybody wasn't on the bus. But mm-hmm. For me, it felt like I had moved, not the majority, but enough to start what I call the ripple effect of change. I had enough people moving or rowing with me, that we would pick up the others as we got going. And until you get that balance, change is really, really hard because it's you slogging up the front, trying to pull people along with you. rowing a very heavy boat. It felt like it changed. And I think the key was, like, my AP was new. He was the only new staff member that I employed. Which was fantastic. So he came with this lens of completely different, been in a high school, been in disadvantaged communities, so understood them, but came with a completely new frame. So he was so great to work with and to bounce off ideas because he didn't have any preconceived ideas about a primary school to begin with or even about the three schools. He had no collective understanding of those three schools. So so him and I just, we were really united in everything that we did. We talked before we made decisions and we always acted exactly the same way, even if he may not have believed me 100%. He always stood beside me and had the same thing, you know, and the same conversation, the same things. We said the same things no matter what we did to kids, parents and staff. It was always united, And then the leadership came on board. My extended leadership became a voice. And then we became one voice for change and working together. So it was distributive. It certainly wasn't me doing it on my own. I did do every single staff member's, it was about 100 and something, PDPs for the first 2 years to set a tone. Number one, I wanted to learn about them. So it wasn't this big stick thing. I actually wanted to know your passions, what you wanted to develop, who you wanted to be, where your growth wanted to be. I also want to celebrate your successes because I wanted to hear from you about how things were going. But I also had an accountability piece that you will have to meet an expectation of this level of teaching, and these are the things that I will do to support you get there. So it was wasn't a big stick. It was certainly more of one of support and coaching, but it definitely was also an accountability piece that I and I wanted consistency with what was happening across the school. I mean, as the years went on, I did certainly only did my leadership team, and I upskilled my leaders to have the other conversations and do all those things. But in the beginning, I just thought it was really important to set a tone of who I was, for them to develop a relationship with me, and for them to understand my decisions were about children. Always about what's best for children.
And out of that, I mean, through that, I suppose, through the thick of it, and you talked about making little, small, incremental steps forward. And I suppose you can see those more clearly now looking back. You know, hindsight's a wonderful thing. But as you were in the thick of it, and those days where I'm sure you closed the office door, and as you say yourself, what on earth have I done? You know, this just does not seem to be working. At the moment, with what I can see in front of me, this is a real uphill challenge. What would you say, I mean, if you were to try and narrow it down to just one or two things from your coaching skills, what would have been the main areas that you felt really you drew strength from your coaching skills, right, in that those most difficult times?
Yeah, I think for me, being true to myself, that's always important, and true to the journey that I take and who I am and my beliefs, that was really important. I think it was also being open to what others had to say and think. I'd obviously made decisions and used research and informed practice to what I thought was going to work, but I had to be open to how it was contextualized to our school, because each school's different and each of the needs are different. So I was really open to what others had to say, but I also was really had real perseverance and courage to stay the ground that I know we needed to stay to get the outcomes, because ultimately my job was to make better outcomes for kids in their learning from disadvantaged communities that were so low. I mean, I wanted these kids to be able to go on to university and have lives and stay at school and have grounded behaviour so that they could be functioning in society. So ultimately, you know, that was my goal. And I never lost sight of that, I don't think. But along the way, I had a real sense of responsibility to develop others and bring them with me. And that could be from the person who was the cleaner at the school to my AP who sat directly beside me. So I didn't differentiate that. I believe that everyone's got and should have opportunities to learn. And I think that compassion, empathy, and positivity is what brought people in line with me, because I was genuine. I really was genuine about what I wanted to achieve. And don't get me wrong, I've got an edge. All principals have got an edge, and you have to have an edge. You don't survive the job if you don't. And do I have to be tough at times and make really tough decisions? Absolutely. Do you know what I mean? But grounded in that, I was always honest about the decisions I had to make. So if I was making a really tough decision that some staff it would impact and they weren't happy about it, I explained why I was doing that. I was really transparent about that. This is the reasons I'm making this decision. I know this isn't what you want or what you feel is the best, but this is the reason I'm making this decision. And I allowed them to talk about that too. And but it didn't mean I was going to change my opinion either or change the course of action. But so giving people an opportunity to be heard, I think, is really important. I think it's also about knowing that I didn't have all the answers. I honestly at times just didn't know what to do. I was like, oh, my God, this is really hard. We'd sit down together and we'd problem solve as a leadership team. We'd reach out to other experts. I'd reach out to other schools. I'd reach out to my SEAL. I was lucky enough to be appointed a coach and a mentor my first year. So I was really lucky. I had someone that I could – he came and chatted with me once a week and we just, you know, talked and pondered, and he was more probably a growth coach because he didn't give me answers. He allowed me to find my answers, but he just listened and propped me up at times when I thought maybe I wasn't going to make it and gave me maybe the centering to think about what I needed to do again. Coaching was key, Richard, I think, because it was different with each person I had to work with, and whether it was a conversation or it was modelling, even down to me doing yard duty and doing exactly what the staff did. I did yard duties every day. I did the gate duty because that's about that modelling and coaching of your expectations. I had the hard conversations, you know, and I challenged parents and I stood up for staff when parents were really inappropriate in their behaviour, and I became the front line for that. So I think your coaching and supporting all the time by your behaviour, your integrity, the choices you make. But I also showed them I was vulnerable, I think, too, which I think is important. Mm-hmm. Because I think to begin with, I thought I was this superhuman person that was just going to come in and clean up and change. But
yes.
I also needed to let them know that it was actually hard. It wasn't an easy task, and there were times when I honestly thought I couldn't do it and I had to lean on my team to step in. And I think that was really important too. I didn't realise probably how important that was until later. I think we can try to be these super people, but that's just unrealistic. And when I made mistakes, I absolutely owned them. Absolutely owned them and said, oh, God, I think I got a bit wrong here. Really sorry. Let's see how we can move forward in a better way. Or if I behaved in the wrong way or I did something that I thought was a bit harsh or I maybe reacted in a way that I didn't feel was the right way with a parent, student or staff member because of the stress around me, I owned it and I apologised and I repaired the relationship and moved on. And I think that's probably key to it as well.
Absolutely. And that's a fantastic list of, you know, I suppose your coaching experience and coaching skills and how it has benefited you in this, you know, very, very challenging role. But it's interesting listening back to that. The very first thing that you mention in your coaching approach to the whole challenge of amalgamating schools is ultimately we're about raising outcomes for the pupils. And at the moment, and for some time, you know, there's been a lot of debate, you know, online and various blog posts and on social media around coaching and how to do coaching and how to do coaching well. And ultimately, you start your list off with, it's about raising outcomes for pupils. And you can see that coming through very, very clearly. And, you know, in our conversation today, whenever you're bringing these three tribes together, you're being consistent. You're setting very, very high expectations. Ultimately, to raise expectations and outcomes for the pupils that you're working with, which is probably why, you know, within that 9-month period, you're starting to hear a change in the vocabulary. People are starting to talk about our pupils. And I would imagine as a principal, it must have been, you know, a lovely moment to hear people to start talking about our children. So these three groups of children coming together into one building and into one school to hear the staff and potentially the parents and the community talking about, you know, these are our children, which you know, has given me a real lift just listening to that, Justine, and it'll be really, really beneficial for folks who are listening. Justine, you've shared with us an amazing story, thoroughly enjoyed it with us today. I'm really intrigued as to what's next for Justine Smith. When I hear what you've done over the last couple of years, what would be the ideal next chapter for you in your career if you could choose it?
Oh, my goodness. Do you know what? I actually don't know. I'm a little bit lost, Richard. I think that I do know that there are things I do know, and I guess I'm going to do another year at the academy, and I think that's a really wonderful opportunity. I'm loving the learning. I'm loving the different experiences. I'm loving the time to sit back and reflect on who I am as a leader and what that means to me moving forward, and the things that I've learnt that I'll apply to my next role. So I think I'm really enjoying that reflective period. And I think when we're in schools and we do intense work, we don't have a lot of time for ourselves because we give so much of ourselves to others. So it's been a really lovely year to have time to reflect on me and who I am. And I've done lots of wonderful learning this year, which is fantastic. So I'm going to do another year at the academy because I've got some work I'm doing that I still don't feel finished. I feel like I have to finish something I've started before I move on to the next. And I think I'm still got a little bit of work I want to do at the academy. So I've got some work to do there. I don't know. I don't think I'm done with schools, Richard. It doesn't feel done when I talk to you now, when I talk about schools. It doesn't feel done for me. I think, you know, I wouldn't mind, and I guess it's got to be challenging for me too. I don't think I can just go into a school now and be a principal in the school down the road, because I think after my last challenge, I thrive on being extended, and I thrive on that challenge, although it's hard. So I don't know whether it's a new school in another area. I do know that I need to do a different area, that my husband and I are going to move closer to town, and that I'm going to have some different areas and different people to work with, because I think that'll be really rewarding for me and very I'd love, you know, the chance to work with other people and different demographics and all those sort of things. So I do know that. But I'm not sure. And I guess for the first time in my life, I'm actually okay with that, Richard, the uncertainty.
But that's a lovely place to be, you know, and it's really quite encouraging for me, Justine, even in this short conversation we've had, for you to hear and have this conversation about the challenges you've had amalgamating these three schools. One thing you've taken away from this is, do you know what, I really thrive on that challenge. You know, there's a bit of clarity there that, and to use your phrase, I'm not done with schools, which is a lovely thing to think. You know, there's still going to be challenges out there, and I love to be challenged. So, you know, this conversation hopefully has been, you know, beneficial for you too. It will have been beneficial to everybody that's listening, which is just terrific. And I want to say a huge thank you, Justine. I really have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation today, and I do want to say thanks, you know, for sharing your story with us, and what an amazing story it has been. Your leadership over the years has clearly had a real positive impact on others, and clearly continues to do so. Thank you for sharing your insights on how your coaching skills and coaching approach to leadership throughout the amalgamation process has played a significant role in, as again John Cotter states, mobilizing three groups of people to jump into a better future. For our listeners, I'm quite sure you will have found inspiration with Justine's story that will serve to motivate you as you continue to develop a coaching culture within your own specific context. In the meantime, don't forget to make good use of the Growth Coaching website, where you can access a broad range of excellent and free coaching resources. In the meantime, I'm looking forward to joining you all again on the next episode of the Coaching in Education podcast, where theory and good intentions meet reality.